Brian Beatty. Welcome to our third edition. Our theme this month is luck, good, bad, and otherwise. A tip of my cap, you might suspect, to the Irish, just in time for St. Patrick's Day. But it's also a nod to my formative years, to the philosophical education I received each week when my family tuned in to the syndicated country music variety show, Hee Haw. Many of you probably owe Camus for your understanding of such philosophical concepts as gloom, despair, and agony. I owe Grandpa Jones, who each week reminded me that if it weren't for bad luck, he'd have no luck at all. But back to the Irish. Our featured storyteller this month is Bill Watkins, the Minister of Culture at Merlin's Rest Pub in Minneapolis. And that's where I caught up with Bill, and he shared these three stories. Cheers.
The time I worked in Scotland, and I worked in the film industry, and I supplied lighting and lighting crews and electrical equipment to a whole bunch of productions, whether they be commercials or historical dramas or occasional feature films. I didn't like feature films that much. The hours were too long, and there was always too much politics involved in them, you know. But I like the smaller unit stuff where I'd be going out on location, and we'd be staying in these fantastic old castles and beautiful old country houses and that, in the most picturesque parts of Scotland. And that to me was just so heartening, you know. But like anything else, you have to take the rough with the smooth. And I did a series of medical films set in West of Hales, where they shot, or where the story of train spotting was kind of centred, you know, around the young people's drug culture and the awful fallout from all of that. And it was a very, very sad process of several weeks of filming people, some of which who died of AIDS and complicated issues during the course of the filming. And it was all AIDS transposed by intravenous drug use. And it was horrible. And anyway, I had a job come in out of the blue with a video unit that I worked with a lot in Edinburgh. And over the years, I'd helped them set up their own video studio, and I'd put a lot of my lighting equipment in there. So they were good friends of mine, and very close to the to my operations. And so if a job came up, I usually had first refusal on it. But anyway, the job came along, and it was the wrap of this AIDS film. And the next day, I would be travelling with a unit truck all the way to Eastbourne in England. Nice little jaunt. Anyway, we all went out to dinner at the end of the wrap. And for some unknown reason, I decided on eating pork and apple sauce, which I hadn't eaten since I was a child. And I went home, and I became so violently ill in the middle of the night that I really thought I was going to die. And I managed to get hold of one of my friends, and I told him, would he ever contact the production company first thing in the morning and tell them I'm in no fit state to drive a unit truck, you know, 300 miles. And I probably won't be for a couple of days, so they might be well advised getting somebody else. And lo and behold, they were very sympathetic. One of the other guys who was lined up, but also got food poisoning from the same place. So the unit from Scotland all went down to Eastbourne. And that was all fine. They did their week shoot in there. And I came back up. And I was better by that time, of course. And I said, how did you get on? Oh, there was an English fella down there, and we got the English fella, local English fella, and he did a grand job, and everything was lovely. And this is where food poisoning can possibly be the luckiest thing in the world. Shortly after this occurrence, about a month, it's little over a month, I think, every single member of that film crew was arrested. And they were interrogated for days on end by the spooks. And it's because they had stayed in a hotel in Brighton where a bomb went off a month later and almost killed Mrs. Thatcher in her cabinet. In fact, it killed a few people, and it also blew the bollocks off of Norman Tebbit, who was the Minister of Employment. Being an Irishman and an electronics expert, and coming from a family in Ireland that had historical ties with the struggle for freedom, if I hadn't had that food poisoning, I'd have probably seen 10 years in prison at least. So sometimes a little pork and apple and a few little bugs can be your best friend. The travelling people say to have luck is to make luck. And sometimes it means there's a little bit of decision making in the process. And one time during the days when I was working on the film units, and I was out there on my own in the wilds of Scotland in my little Volkswagen van with all my lighting equipment on racks inside it, and it was a kind of a comfortable feeling to be hurtling through the night to some destination where you'd be rigging your lights the next day and shooting a movie, or even better, coming home after a successful hunt. So anyway, I was coming out of Aberdeen one time on the old road that leads south, and the sun was setting and there were long shadows and it was very golden, and I had a choice by Stonehaven. There's a fork in the road, and the road either goes inland, which is a quicker way back to the Southlands by Edinburgh, where I was living, or you could take the coast road. And with the gloaming, as the Scots call it, the beautiful light in the sky of the setting sun, I just decided it would be nice to take the coast road and maybe see if there's any ships sailing out there, or fishing boats or something, to be in this vast and this beautiful light. And so I turned left and headed off down the coast. Now, the Volkswagen has a very peculiar foible. With being an air-cooled engine, everything in a Volkswagen is wonderful as long as the big fan's turning. If ever you see the red light comes on to say the fan has stopped turning, you've got about 10 seconds to shut the engine off before the minuscule amount of oil in it evaporates and it seizes into a solid block. And I just got to the top of this hill on my little road heading down towards the coast, and the red light pops up on my dashboard, and I say what generations of sailors have said for years before: oh shit. So I switch the engine off, and I'm in the middle of nowhere. But in front of me is probably 3 or 4 miles of downhill coasting. And I think, well, I'm stuck wherever I'm stuck. I might as well be stuck at the bottom of the hill as the top of one. And I clattered all my way down until I'd picked up a good bit of speed, and I got a good few miles down the road. And just as I start to peter out of speed, I come round the corner and there's a lay-by by the side of the road. And I pull over into the lay-by so that I don't stall out into the road where I might be hit by another car. And in the lay-by, up on bricks, is a Volkswagen van. And in the back of the Volkswagen van is the very fan belt that I required for my van. And I stopped dead behind it, just through the inertia of the vehicle. Took my toolkit out, swapped them over, and I was on the road in 5 minutes. And if I'd have taken the quicker route down the inside of the country, I'd have been stuck in the arsehole of nowhere with only God for guidance. There was a man years ago, and we used to call him the tallest man in the world. And I'm sure he wasn't the tallest man in the world, but us Irish folks, for the most part, being under 5'8", he was probably six foot eight. And he was a lovely, what you might call one of these plausible English chaps, you know. Very, very posh, very well educated, a big long string bean of a man with the real haughty attitude of the British Raj. He would have been perfect in India, surrounded with sepoys and memsabs, having tiffin on the veranda in the afternoon and then sozzling himself rotten in the shebeens at night. With the shufti bints and plenty of gin and tonic. But he was an absolute scurrilous chap. I loved him dearly. He was always up to some wicked scheme. And he also loved anything to do with boats, which is very strange because he came from a long line of landlubbers. But I'd been in the Merchant Marine as a radio operator, and so he thought I knew all about boats. Now, possibly the only person on a ship that knows virtually nothing about a ship is the radio officer, because they spend all the time sitting in the radio shack listening to the wireless and reading books, and most of the time they're listening to the wireless, they're probably listening to the BBC. But anyway, since he was a nautical cove, he came to me one night in the pub, and he had a scheme. And like his scheme, all of his schemes, they were all money-making, allegedly. In their concept, they were money-making. So some rich friend of his had a beautiful yacht built, hand-built. And I said, oh, very good. I said, what yard turned it out? Oh, it wasn't turned out by a yard. It was turned out by an enthusiast. I thought, oh, that's good. Uh-huh. Where's this enthusiast? Oh, he lives up in the Pennine Mountains in England. So he lives in the middle of England, up in the mountains, and he makes boats? Yeah. Ocean-going yachts. And has he made many of these? Oh, no, this is the first one. Uh-huh. All right. Well, he says, there's £500 in it for you if you help crew her from Liverpool to Ireland, to Dublin, Ireland. And I said, well, I'm the first to tell you, apart from me survival training in lifeboats, I don't know an awful lot about yachting or trimming sails or anything else. I said, I know, I'm one of these people who know the difference between a boat and a ship. A boat fits on a ship doesn't fit on a boat. So he says, oh, well, he says, I've only got yourself and another chap who's never been to sea at all, so we might spend the whole thing being seasick. So as luck would have it, the boat gets delivered up to Liverpool, and my friend, the tallest man in the world, he goes up to meet it, and then he's to call me, and I'm to go up on the train and meet up with him and the other crewman and we're to put it in the water in Liverpool, and then we'll sail it. So I said to him, well, how about navigation? Does it have any navigation devices on board? It's nothing on board. It's not fitted out yet. It's just got the engine, some basic sails, and navigation lights. I said, well, does it have a radio? No, there's no radio. He said, well, we could take a walkie-talkie with us. I said, oh, that'll be really handy out in the middle of the Irish Sea. I said, well, it's got a compass and everything. No, I said, I thought we'd just follow the Irish ferry across. I said, how many knots does this engine do? Oh, I think it does 6 or 7. I said, well, the Irish ferry will leave you in its wake. They'll be doing about 15. And that's them just cruising, not even with the foot down. Oh, he says, well, we could follow the wake. I said, you might end up in America if you miss. So anyway, this thing's delivered up to the port, and the port authorities take one look at it, and they say, what do you think you're going to do with that? Well, we're going to put it in the water and sail it across to Ireland. The fella says, not out of here, you're not. I said, why not? I said, well, you need permission. Where's the certificates for this thing? What certificate? Well, is it certified? Is it seaworthy? Well, it's brand new. Well, that doesn't matter. It's got to be seaworthy. Ah. I arrive up there, find a lot of people looking at this huge thing, scratching their heads. And eventually, somebody sees the light of day and says, ah, yeah. It's probably not a good idea to be sailing this across. And then the weather started getting bad. And the port authority says, there's no bloody way you're going to do it. I said, but if you put her on blocks and on a low loader, you can take her across as cargo on the ship. Take the masts down, drive her in. And so, indeed, that was that. I got a kiss me ass and a thank you for turning up. And I went away. I thought no more of it. Anyway, the yacht, for want of a better name, was delivered to the owner, who had cruising rights on the lakes of Killarney. That's all he wanted it for. And so she was fitted out down at one of the little porteens on the lakes of Killarney. And he gathered his family and a lot of picnic baskets and a lot of drink and a lot of strong drink. And they all piled aboard the yacht and off they went. And they pulled into a lovely little island and they set up their picnic and they had a wonderful afternoon of eating and drinking and conviviality and loveliness. And about 6 hours later, they went back to the boat and there was no sign of the boat. And he says, somebody stolen the boat. And one of the Irish fellas says, they left a piece of it here and another bit over there. And there's more of it where the tide has washed it round the cove. And there was the boat, back in its kit form, exactly as it had been made. It had been in the water for 6 hours, just long enough to dissolve the water-soluble glue that the idiot who built it had put it together with.
Bill Watkins is also the author of a trilogy of memoirs, A Celtic Childhood, Scotland Is Not for the Squeamish, and The Once and Future Celt. Thanks for listening. Our editorial calendar, submission guidelines, and more are available anytime at mnartists.org and on our Facebook page. You Are Here is a monthly literary podcast production of mnartists.org. mnartists.org is a joint project of the Walker Art Center and the McKnight Foundation. The mission of mnartists.org is to improve the lives of Minnesota artists and provide access to and engagement with Minnesota's arts culture.